welcome to the Transcontinental Daily Podcast, episode 11. I'm Tom Probert, and I'm coming to you live from the front line of Ferrygate in Beșeț, on the banks of the Danube in Romania. So our two support cars met up today after days and days apart on the race, covering different areas of the action. I'm delighted to say that we've got race reporter Ross joining us on the pod tonight. Welcome, Ross.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. And Tom is visibly happier than he has ever been since CP1.
It's fun to get the band back together. We've also got Karen back on the pod tonight, and of course Rob Quirk, as always, every episode. I guess, how are you doing today?
Evening, glad to be back.
So last time we spoke, Christoph had finished, and we had a few riders approaching the finish on the final parkour. So what's the state of play now? Quite a bit's been going on, hasn't it, at the finish in Burgas?
So when you spoke yesterday, we'd only had Christoph, Christian and Adam arrive at the finish. We've had quite a flurry of arrivals come through today. So we've got the first 10 arrivals now in through the gate. So fourth arrival yesterday evening at about 10:30 was Marin de Saint-Exupéry. And he had been absolutely... mais bien sûr. He'd been storming his way down since he came off the control point for parkour. I mean, Ross, maybe you've had a chat with him and you can fill us in on what on earth was propelling him to go that fast. It was amazing seeing him just kind of sweep past everyone yesterday.
Marin was actually really quite humble about his own abilities when I spoke to him yesterday, because obviously Marin had a bit of a, he described it as a crazy bad start to the TCR this year after heading pretty far south. I think you guys definitely spoke about it in the daily pod.
Yeah, the exciting route.
the really far south route through Germany. And he was also having a really nasty time with just lots of napping, feeling really unwell. And so he rolled into CP1 in about 32nd place, I think. But he clawed his way back up the leaderboard and I think was seventh by the time he got to CP4. And then from there, he just had an absolute flyer down the River Olt and arrived at the ferry terminal. Sort of, I think he got the 11:30 ferry yesterday morning.
He was on his own, wasn't he?
But he said he hadn't really done anything different in the ride, except that he had just been more consistent and he'd just been taking advantage of the fact that others had slowed down. So yeah, he was quite humble about it, but you could see that he just had that grin and twinkle in his eye, which meant that he had some lightning fast finish to come ahead of the likes of Ulrich and Pavel, who got a ferry like 2 or 3 hours earlier than he did. So it was a phenomenal comeback.
And then, so next in was Pavel, wasn't it?
Yeah, so then Pavel, I guess about an hour later, and I think he had just by about 30 minutes missed his wife's birthday. Poor timing, poor effort. But he arrived, there's an amazing photo of him arriving with kind of flowers in his arms and some cake. So, I mean, that's pretty impressive to have the wherewithal to even know what
is
day it is.
Is that why Marin overtook him? Was he buying flowers in a shop?
Yeah.
I mean, but, priorities. I think he had the right priority there.
Well, it takes a while to bake a cake. We factor that into the time. How long is he would have definitely come in fourth if not might have beaten Adam.
We were joking earlier that had Pavel's wife just stayed on Central European time, then he would have actually been on time. But instead she's in Bulgaria and he was 30 minutes late. So I don't know who could be blamed here.
Oh, the technicalities.
It's all race time.
Yes.
So then about 20 minutes later came in Ulrich. So I've lost track now. What position was he in when he left control point two? Second Whoa. Place. And then came yes. in seventh
second
in the
place.
End.
Yes, seventh in the end. But despite like an enormous number of setbacks, I think Ulrich came into this, I think for some people, as kind of the really calculating, dialed in. He went to Andorra to do altitude training. He knew all of his data wow. points. I think Tom interviewed him before the race, and it was just like he knew his heart rate variability. He knew his power output. He knew what he was going to do. And then by the end of that, he came out very much as a very sensitive and quite humble rider. And I'm really interested to ask him what he's taken from this race that he maybe hasn't from others. Because I think he probably has learned a lot. And I certainly saw him change throughout the race from this very strong-willed and always strong-willed, to be honest, but he just had that, he just kept going, didn't he?
Mm. Yeah. Relentless drive to continue despite all the setbacks that he went through. And I think you're right that he went from this guy that was completely in control of everything and very, very calm and confident to, in the end, someone who had been through so much that he'd had to really face up to the fact that things can go wrong and have gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you manage to chat to him, Ross, on the finish line at all?
No, well, we're still in Romania, but in terms of the ferries, we had a bit of a faux pas where we actually arrived at the ferry terminal like 4 minutes after it had departed with Ulrich, Pavel, Adam and Christian all aboard. So it was just, it wasn't the finest hour, but this is what happens. We didn't realize it was quite so far away. So, yeah.
Do you find the distances get deceptive in this race when you're used to people covering such huge amounts of ground in a day?
Yeah, you start to get a bit complacent about how fast you can go in a car versus how quickly a rider goes somehow.
Yeah, well, it's funny being here now in Bechet and the other ferry terminal is on the map. And when we were talking about it before, it's like, oh, okay, we've missed that ferry, or it's just going to pop across to the next ferry. It's 80K. And like, so we're talking about going over there tomorrow, and even in a car, that's an hour and a quarter, or maybe probably end up being an hour and a half drive.
So the
distances get so distorted because you get so normalized to the insane distances these guys are riding just as a matter of course. And yeah, it's several times we found ourselves trying to chase down riders into control points and giving ourselves what we thought was like quite a comfortable amount of time to do it. And then ending up being like, God, I hope they, get to the mountain soon so they start climbing and we can catch them up. So anyway, who came in after Ulrich then?
Yeah. So then we had a bit of a gap of about 6 hours until the next morning. Robin came in just after 5 a.m. in the morning, followed by Fiona, the first woman to finish, then Andrew Phillips, and then a couple of hours ago, Christianis Rattening. And I think we've got David Mixell on the parkour just coming up to the finish as we speak.
Yep, along with Stefan Lombard now, who's just started the parkour. And he is one of the riders who at CP3 was about to scratch, was on the cusp of saying, just throw in the towel, I've lost too much time. And then he said, what position am I in? And then there was like, you're in ninth. And he was like, a ninth? What? I lost like 10 hours. And then he's like, well, I guess all the pain in my knee is inconsequential. He was like, let's go. Yeah. And he just set off back up the road.
So, amazing. Yeah, and good job he did, isn't it?
Good job he did.
Didn't scratch. That's a brilliant effort. And just out of those riders rounding out that top 10, Robin's been one of my favourite riders, having met him. Just amazing to watch him on the bike. I found it just really quite inspiring watching him descend when he was in full flight and feeling really good and descending. Like, he's just so good at bike handling and just looks so elegant on the bike, and he's just a really interesting character as well, isn't he? Really funny. And he's one of those, a bit like what we were talking about with Ulrich, who he will have learned so much from this race because he was so confident and, you know, like healthily confident, but also a little bit cocky in a good way when he was leading the race. And he was saying like, oh no, I don't see myself cracking. And then I think when you caught up with him at CP3, he had fully cracked and was feeling quite humbled by the whole experience.
Yeah, he was definitely like, what was I saying? I'm not going to crack. Of course I was going to crack. And he definitely had been humbled by the race. And he said that a number of times. And then I caught up with him yesterday morning, just before he caught the ferry. And he was very philosophical about his race. I kind of asked him, you know, he said, I don't know whether this is a first or a last. And then he sort of started talking about how he had really enjoyed racing the way he had. I would equate him to similar to like Mathieu van der Poel, you know, attacking constantly and just throwing caution to the wind just to animate the race, which is what he did. And he said he wanted to do. But, and then he kind of chatted and then he sort of said, yeah, but maybe next time I'll do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, oh, so there'll be a next time. And he was like, yeah, I just realized I said that.
Yeah.
So I think Robin's definitely one to watch out for some kind of races like the Three Peaks or the Two Folgueno Sprint.
A shorter race.
A short, like, you know, 1,200 up 2,000 kilometer race. He could really set the cat amongst the pigeons there. I mean, he already has, but...
I've just realized as well, Robin is... he's a veteran of the Red Hook Crits. So he was super high placing in those races. For those who don't know, it's like fixed gear crits that took place in famous cities like Barcelona, Brooklyn, London, Milan. And they're very intense, very fast. Well, it seems like the absolute opposite end of what an ultra race is. So it's just mind-boggling to see how many disciplines he seems to just excel in. You know, he's not just specializing in one area. He's really doing it all. And yeah, seeming as this is his first ultra, or maybe his first ultra on this scale, that he's done so well. But yeah, once he's got the experience under his belt, he will definitely come back with a lot more knowledge.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot more. I think, like, one of the key things with when you do an event, like when you do an ultra, is the thing that you take away is understanding, like, that the feelings you get or the pains that come or the problems you face, once you've already been there once, when you're doing it again, then you have the confidence to just deal with it and to push on. And I think that counts for a lot in ultras. So, you know, if he gets that under his belt, I think he'll be really formidable.
Absolutely. And we have to talk about Fiona a little bit, of course, because coming back as kind of reigning champ, she's been through a lot of adversity in this race, and it's so good to see her finishing the top 10. I don't think she necessarily had any expectation at the start of the race, so I think she'll be delighted with that, really. And you spent quite a bit of time there, haven't you, at different parts of the race catching up.
I thought you were going to say at the front of the race or something like that. I was like, definitely not. She was really fun to talk to last night, just before she caught the ferry alongside Andrew Phillips, who absolutely emptied himself to reach the last ferry of the day and wheeled into the ferry terminal with his hands prayed to the sky, thanking whoever had blown him down the River Olt to get to the ferry on time. Fiona was very... I did the fool's thing of asking her, you've kind of downplayed your ambitions, and she was like, no, I've not downplayed my ambitions. I had no ambitions. I just came here to try stuff out. And she was very clear that she'd only ridden 5,000 kilometers before the race, so like this year so far, and has basically doubled that by doing transcontinental, which is quite a feat. And when we spoke to her last night, she really tried to emphasize the fact that she was feeling really good by doing a set of pistol squats, like single leg squats in the car park of a ferry terminal, which was not what I expected. And she initially tried to do it with a musette around her neck, which just, it was not going to work. So yeah, she's really done incredibly well. And even though that placing there of eighth position, and even though she said that this her route this year is probably the longest that she has known the transcontinental to be, she's still only come, I think, a few hours behind the time that she did in 2019.
Oh, really? I haven't checked that yet.
Yeah, like, I think she may have, yeah, she's gone faster because it's over a greater distance.
Yeah.
So it's incredible how she's managed to keep that form despite now being working full-time as a surgeon. You know, in 2019 she was just out of medical school, so she had far more time to train. So this is a real testament to her endurance.
I think it's also worth pointing out that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's only Fiona and Juliana Böhring who are the only women to get top 10 finishes in the TCR. So it's great to see Fiona like pulling that again a second year in a row. And if Amri stays on track, she's in the top 20, so she will be in again a unique position, or you know, in small company of like again Juliana, Fiona, and then Amri being the only female riders to hit the top 20. So I really hope she can pull that off. I'd love to see that happen.
Speaking of Amri, she's just come across the River Danube in the last, couple of hours? Like, I think she was...
Yeah, 3 hours ago.
3 hours ago she came over there. So we've effectively got like a new batch of riders being dropped off onto that final sort of approach to the finish. So Amri came over on the ferry. Was that the eastern one?
Yeah, she took, over Zimnesia.
Yeah, that's right, with Joe Dorset, who's also been a very entertaining rider on this year's race, doing lots of quite funny mistakes but really not being fazed by it.
What's he been up to? What's Joe Dorset been up to?
That's not Hamburger Joe, is it? Do you remember
go on,
the third TCR, I'm trying to remember the name, but I think it was the third TCR or the number four, we had Hamburger Joe, who's super young. Quite a young rider, but quite strong. He turned up in an aero suit. The skin
about.
Suit. It's not the same Joe, is it?
I know who you're talking about. I don't think it's the same guy.
Yeah, because it's Joseph. Right?
Yeah, that's he does. But I don't think it's the same guy. I know who you're talking about, but yeah.
Yeah, I think he had a penchant for eating hamburgers on the race, so he got the nickname Hamburger Joe.
That's great.
Which would look good in a skin suit, yeah.
Well, Joseph Dorset missed the first control point, didn't he?
Yes.
He was on the parkour and he just went straight past the control point. He went over Stelvio. Control point two, he went over the Stelvio pass, which you really don't need to do, but that was just his route. And then he got into a lot of trouble up there in the weather, got really really cold and wet, and then found a hotel that was it was closed, as in like, you know, you couldn't go in there and get a room, but the actual front door was open. So he just went in, picked a key off, you know, they have the keys all displayed on the little pegs, just got a key and went into the room and just had a shower and then left before anyone else was up.
Was this hotel empty?
No, it was like full of people.
I was going to say, was it like you was just stepped into the...
It was just someone's house.
No. And then something else happened to him.
Oh, CP3, he took a really... Well, because there were sort of three main... There was really two main routes people were taking to get actually, you know, over into Montenegro. And that was that main border crossing in the north that took you then along Lake Piva to Blujin. And then a lot of other people took that border crossing that Rob has been talking about quite a bit, which is that what was previously gravel crossing, which is now freshly tarmacked, over to west side of Plugin. Yeah. So I thought
it's been graded.
Yeah, I know. So when you guys have been talking about it, I spoke to Christian Jakobek, who was the first one to come over that border, and I asked him how was the gravel, and he was like, it's not gravel anymore. And I was like, what? So he found the one bit that's tarmacked over the border of Bosnia into Montenegro, while a lot of other people ended up just missing it and taking the gravel. So there is a fresh tarmac road. So those were the two main crossings. But then Joseph Dorset decided to just throw caution to the wind, and he went way far south, coming in from the south road to Plugin. And I asked him about it, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm just touristing around the place. Don't mind me."
Just touristing his way into the top 20.
Yeah, that's as you do.
Simple. And then, Karen, you've been having a look at Michael Broadwith, Cap 170, going on about his adventures. And what's he been up to?
I did spot yesterday lunchtime. I was like, what on earth is number 170 doing up there? There was someone kind of just floating way north of the control point 4. And then I clicked on the dot and I was like, oh, it's Michael Broadwith. You know, of all people, I'd have thought he maybe knows a bit what he's doing, what's going on here. But anyway, it's all been coming out today. He's had a bit of an adventure. So as I understand it, he's already had some issues at control point 3 with, I think, is it his tyre pretty much falling apart? So his tyres are kind of bodged together with Gorilla tape, or at least they were at some point. Maybe they're replaced with new tyres now, not sure, probably not. But yeah, then as I understand it, the control point 4 issue was essentially just a big old routing error that got a bit out of control. I think he planned to take a slightly more northerly route than what we're seeing a lot of the other riders do. So essentially trying to kind of go around the top of some mountains between control point 3 and 4 instead of going kind of under and to the east of them like everyone else.
Okay.
But essentially got a bit caught out because the way into control point 4 from that direction was actually either via a motorway or via another band road, I'm not sure. And there wasn't really any way for him to get to the control point without having to do a massive, essentially 170-kilometer diversion round another mountain range to come into the control point kind of from the due north, whereas everyone else has been coming up from the south. So that's kind of a good old half-day schlepping round that he wouldn't have planned for. But I have to say, I've just been trying to look on the map a bit earlier, and it does look like there are now quite a lot more people that seem to be taking a slightly different route to control point 4, and I wonder if there are now some more people that are going to be making the same mistake as him. Like if you see number 18, Christine Camera, I'm not sure if that's the same way in that Michael Broadwith took, and she might be in a similar situation soon. Yeah, I was trying to look.
Oh yeah, I see what you mean. Christine Camarera is trying to head that way as well. I kind of see what the logic is, because as you, I think you guys have discussed before, TCR has this cruel sort of like habit of putting in sneaky climbs that aren't on the parkour, but you have to do in order to do the parkour. And the Transalpina is one of those climbs. It goes to 2,000 meters. And it's, as you saw, the guys coming into CP4, they were wrapped in jackets. It's blooming Baltic up there. And I think Michael tried to pull a sneaky one by avoiding the Transalpino, but the Transalpino was not having any of that. So yeah, he kind of got landed at the side of an E-road, and yeah, he's had to do a bit extra mileage. But he did seem quite sort of sanguine about it on social media, where he said 4,200 kilometers, he said 110 kilometers in a 4,200 kilometer race. Bah!
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And coming from a maths teacher, that must be legit.
There's another little group now, isn't there, that are stuck on the sort of north bank of the Danube for the night because there are no ferries going now. So they've got to wait for that first ferry, and we're going to go and try and find them in the morning, I think, before they make their crossing. So who have we got in that group?
We've got Robert Webb, who I believe is on a Quirk bike. Max Reiser, Dennis Froese, and Aidan Alcock. I think they were the four that looked to be kind of almost queuing up and potentially bedding down at the port tonight. Still on their way in, some of them, but they will be there soon.
I think this will be quite fun tomorrow morning because, I mean, all those four are all there bright and early, and there's a good, how many riders behind that might make it? Maybe another four or five?
I'm sure I saw Megan was heading down as well.
She's not far. She's not far. So, yeah, I reckon another five riders will get in. So we know tomorrow morning there's going to be a good old race to the finish. All of these guys, I think some of them will be in a chance to be in the top 20. I think most of them will get into top 25. So, some good places to fight for.
Yeah, one of the names to really look at on that one is Stefan Uaja and Theo Daniels are making their way to the Danube, and we'll be hoping for a full-on time trial to Burgas because they have the ability to draft one another. So...
Yeah, we saw them today, actually, and they're in pretty good spirits, having kind of had a bit of a drama and a bit of a falling apart as a pair at one point in the race, and they seem to be back together and working in harmony again in good spirits. We even got a bit of a song out of Stefan, which was a nice little treat. So, when do we think they're going to get to the river then?
This is the deceiving thing about the map, actually, because we've been watching this all of the past 2 days, and people take a lot longer than you think to come from sort of Pitești. Adam was there, I think. Slatina, they can definitely get to the ferries for tomorrow morning. If they're at Slatina now, you're definitely getting a ferry tomorrow. For those guys who are just kind of leaving the mountains in like Pitești, that is a lot further than you think, although it is very, very flat. So Stefan and Theo definitely do have an advantage there because they are able to draft one another.
Interesting.
So I would say they'll sneak in a late afternoon ferry, I think. I don't think they'll be there early enough for a morning ferry, and they'll maybe want to sleep or something before getting on it.
Because it's basically just flat, isn't it? All of that.
It's pan flat. So pan flat that Christianis Ratanić was photographed looking so bored as he was sat on his tri-bars that he had one arm on the tri-bars and one under his chin, just looking like he'd been there for an eternity.
Yeah. Pitești is 150k from the ferry, and Slatina is 100k. So, not huge distances in the scope of things. But, I mean, one of the things as well, which we haven't really discussed when it comes to PERS, is a lot of people ask, why aren't PERS faster? Because, they have the chance to draft off each other. So logically you'd think they're faster, but when it's working, a pair is probably faster, but they're never you're never on the same timetable when it comes to when you get tired, when you get hungry, when you need to go to the bathroom and all of this. So yeah, when it's working, they're super fast, and when it's not, they're pretty slow. So they're making good progress now. It'd be interesting to see what happens through the night.
I think you're right, Rob. I think the reason as well is perhaps that there is a lot of ascent and descent across Europe. I mean, I think Ulrich's clocked up 42,200 meters, and riding in a pair in that and trying to draft is not effective. You're not getting much of an aerodynamic advantage on a climb. But I guess once they hit these flat plains, that's when the advantage starts to be much more of significance. But then, yeah, like you say, a two-man TT for 160k or something like that is not easy. So
substantial, yeah. Especially at the end of a 4,000 kilometer race.
So control point three, back at that Blues Bar in Dermatol, which Ross knows only too well, closes effectively tonight. It's 1 a.m. 5th of August Central Eastern Standard Summertime. We're still getting our heads around these different time zones.
It's sick.
So now we've got this quite interesting scenario developing with these kind of lantern rouge that are trying to get into CP3 before it closes. So I think you guys have been looking into this a little bit to see what kind of distances these guys have got to cover and how much time they've got to do it in and how they're shaping up. And we were talking about Eric yesterday, weren't we? Eric Veneman, who's one of these guys, but there's kind of a little group of them.
Let's see. So yeah, we're talking about Eric Veneman yesterday and Frederick Rudant. Eric definitely was in with a chance, we worked out. I think he had 400 kilometers to do in 28 hours. He's not posted anything on social since yesterday, which is a good indication that he's gunning it.
Good side, yeah.
I'm just trying to find him on the map right now. I mean, you always know when people go, well, depends who it is, but yeah, normally if people go quiet on social media, it's because they're really putting in the hours.
All of that last group that are kind of potentially gunning it to make it to the last control, to make it to control point three before it closed, I had a look at their social media. None of them have said anything. Just eyes on the prize, keep the legs spinning.
Okay, so I think... Oh, he's really close.
I found Eric. Yeah, he's about to cross the border.
So he's taken the direct route, the middle way. It makes it sound
quite zen. Is that on the gravel? Is that on the gravel or the beautifully smooth tarmac way?
Yeah. But even so, he's within... he's within 50k, I think, definitely. So yeah, I think he's gonna make it unless something on the border goes wrong. But people have actually been moving across there really fast, and you can see he's in good company. Torsten Frank, who's people recognize the name. He's a TCR veteran of many years. He's about to cross the border and get to control point three. I'm trying to find Frederick.
Looks like he's not going to make it. He's about 200 kilometers to go when I last looked about an hour ago. So I think he might have to switch to holiday mode.
And what time is it over there? They're an hour ahead or 2 hours ahead?
It's an hour from Montenegro.
An hour ahead, so that would put it at 10 o'clock. So, yeah, he's got 3 hours to do 200K, which...
Frederick's got it in the bag.
Yeah. there he is, yeah. He's still, yeah. So, sadly, Frederick was the previous Lantern Rouge, so the last rider to pass through CP2 before the cutoff. We will know tomorrow who's going to be our new Lantern Rouge. So something to keep your eye or your ears out for. Of course, you know, Karen spoke of this previously. Being Lantern Rouge is almost as good as being the first person to pull in. You know, the last person definitely gets more cheers than the first when they get to the finish. So it's all to play for. It'd be great to see who it is. What else has been going on?
Can I just give a shout out to Peter Boynton, cap number 208? I've met him on at least two TCRs and know him from riding around London, and he's been very, very unlucky in his previous attempts. He's done at least three, maybe four TCRs before, and for various different reasons hasn't managed to finish. He's been hit by cars and had all sorts of bad luck and illnesses and things. So he's really every time, every year coming back, just trying to finish. And so he looks like he's in this group as well. So how's he doing? How far away is he from the cutoff?
He's
super close.
Yeah, he'll be at the control point with, well, I don't want to jinx it, but you know, he's looking comfortable.
Great. No worries there then. Well done, Pete. Keep it going, mate.
It's funny, actually, because, there must be more than one route over the border, because looking at the way Peter's going, it's not the way I've seen the other riders go. So let's hope he knows what he's doing. Maybe he's on the tarmac and the other riders on the gravel. But he should be popping down. He's so close. So, best of luck, Pete.
Yeah, we did a bit of calculation when Christian Jakobek made it that he took about an hour and 20 minutes from the border on his newly tarmacked route. But it took Stefan Lombard a good 2.5 hours. And I think that was because he ended up on some of the horrible gravel stuff, which is still up there. So if you're unlucky, you could end up getting a little bit stuck on the gravel bits.
That does make it sound like it's a little bit close then for the guys that are almost at the board but not there yet.
It's getting dark as well. It will be dark over there by now.
Yeah.
So which can make it a bit more challenging. I do remember the gravel itself wasn't particularly gnarly, but if you're on a road bike, if you've got road tires, it just makes it a little bit more difficult.
Right, let's quickly do the scratch report. These ones look quite easy to pronounce, so I'm just going to do it. Stuart Featherstone, 108. Andrew Grau, 220. Thomas... Oh no, this one is quite difficult actually.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce that? Thomas.
Careful how you say it.
All right. I'm going to go for it. Dominic Stockton, 218. Does anybody have any stories about like why they've scratched or.
Well, a bit of a sad story about Andrew.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Andrew was hit by a car today just outside of Mostar. And so he was taken to hospital. He has broken his femur, so that is not great. His next of kin have been informed, and I think other than the fact he's got a broken femur, he is okay. So we just really wish Andrew speedy recovery, because not fun. It seems that the road outside of Mostar is a really fast descent into Mostar. I think we were talking earlier about it as a team, and one of the guys, David Ayer, he's been on that road, and he says it's quite twisty and turning, but it's very fast, and you can easily hit 70, 80 kilometers an hour going down it. And if you've got cars coming up the other way, driving like Bosnian drivers tend to, then yeah, you can come a cropper. So yeah, wishing Andrew all the best and just hoping he gets a speedy recovery.
Yeah, get well soon, Andrew. And no pairs have scratched as far as we know. So Karen, it's time for your section.
Oh yeah, the Karen's social media section. Excellent. Well, it's an easy one this time, Tom. I have been having a little scrape around and it's social media has been really quiet today. I think a lot of people are heads down trying to get to that next control point, tired, and just kind of really focused on getting to the end now. But I think there is one nugget which I haven't picked up from the rider's own social media, but I've seen, I know there have been some transcontinental photos, official photos of Daniele Cap 223, who is I think the only rider who's on fixed gear, and he's completed the control point 4 parkour today. So that's the right. Gravelly rocky parkour that's been creating a lot of controversy. I don't know if we got a sense how we managed to get through that, how it's been. I mean, it seems pretty impressive stuff.
He pulled a wheelie the entire way, I heard. And did lots of skids. So
I spoke to him today at Control Point 4, and just before he left, he had to take his wheel off, spin it round, reattach it so that his gearing was correct to do the climb to get up to the parkour. So, you know, there are so many different elements to riding fixed that just make it so much harder. And then you have to go and do an off-road gravel parkour. He looked like he had pretty good tyres to do it in the scheme of things, like probably 32 mil tyres, but also he's on rim brakes. So, you know, that's going to make it harder again. But, you know, he's just, you've got to just salute that and applaud that effort, haven't you, to be doing this.
He's come off the parkour and he's now, his dot is next to the ice cream connoisseur himself, Matthew Falconer. Nice. So maybe he sat down for a late night ice cream. Never know.
I'd like to see some Romanian ice cream.
Yeah, I said there's not been much on social media, but I should have just gone straight to Matt's Instagram to check on the number of ice creams, check what tally we're at.
Well, I saw Matt as well at the same time. Oh. He's up to 42. There's the live update.
Oh my God.
That would be...
He told me sometimes he does a double session.
He's 46
and 47.
So I was going to say, if he's only at 42, he's behind. He's dropped his scheduling a bit and he's dropped the pace on the ice cream consumption. But it's good to hear that
just
he's
being modest.
You know, keeping the pace up. Ross, did you have an update from Bruno?
No, nothing yet. So it still seems Bruno Ferraro has been cited on his social media inside a car. And he says the current situation, broken shifter cable, no big deal. No spare tube and patches not holding the air. Repaired my tire 6 times to ride 10K at a time. Crazy. So there's not really any context as to why he's in a car. It does look from the image like he's in some kind of, you know, in a gunfight or something like that, but we hope that he is not. But yeah, it seems that he's headed to a town just sort of west of Burgas and either to get last minute repairs to be able to make the ride to the finish, he ends up scratching. He's not the only one to have suffered problems on that side of the Danube. I saw her earlier this evening. Amrai has had a couple of issues. She seems to have got a torn sidewall of her tire after the parkour, and also maybe some issues with her rims as well. It's not been an easy time. I think people are sporting a lot of war wounds after the CP4 parkour, but Amarai seems pretty resourceful and was already hacking away at it on the ferry across the Danube to Svistok. So I hope that she manages to get to Burga still keeping her second place position as in the women's race and also a top 20 in the overall.
But once Megan gets over tomorrow morning, she's going to have her hot on her heels.
Yeah. spice it up.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, let's again just pick one listener question because we've been doing this for quite a while now. So we've accumulated a few. Do you guys just want to pick one again to answer?
I think the question about any riders are vegan or vegetarian. So the question was from Eric Emad, and he lives in Sun Prairie. Is that Wyoming, USA?
Wisconsin,
of course. I'm wondering if any of the riders are vegan or vegetarian, and if that presents any unique challenges in staying well-fed, in particular traveling through Europe. Well, I'm not vegan or vegetarian, but I have ridden in similar events with people who are vegan. To be honest, it's really tough for them, and because most things are not vegan. If you stay in a hotel, you'll never get like a vegan breakfast. It's like everything's pretty hard to avoid. So with some of the people I've been with who are vegan, they basically ended up breaking the veganism because they just couldn't get the fuel they needed on this event. I'm sure there's probably some vegan riders that would find that, you know, not okay and you know, and would find their own ways around it. But I think it just it must be incredibly hard, or any sort of dietary requirement, because I imagine even things like being gluten free would be incredibly hard on an event like this, especially as you get into countries where you don't know the language, deciphering what's in the what's in things through the packaging and ingredients list, it must be absolutely tormenting. So, yeah, I'd be interested to know how many riders actually put it on pause if they're able to do that.
Karen, any thoughts on this?
Oh, I don't think I've got that much to add to what Rob said, really. I feel quite overwhelmed at the prospect of anyone trying to keep up vegetarianism or veganism, or any kind of, I mean, obviously some things are kind of dietary choices and some things are kind of medical requirements, so there's more negotiation on some things than others, but it's just, the thought of having to factor that into where you're going to stop, what you can eat, the number of different countries you're going through. You don't have time to kind of acclimatize to one country and learn what you can and can't eat in that one country before you're in the next country and having to work it out all over again. I basically was like a dustbin going around Europe. I would just eat any kind of calorie that came my way. And I have a lot of respect for people that had the kind of willpower to try and keep with their morals whilst in that state of just like deliriousness and fatigue, and hunger and hanger. So maybe we need to ask some vegan or vegetarian riders that question,
because they can't even have Haribo, can they?
If you are a vegan or vegetarian rider, then write in and let us know how it's been. The problem, obviously, when you're riding is that you need to get in a lot of calories. You need to get in a lot of calories, and you need to get in those calories really fast. And so both of those things, and cheaply as well, and they need to be readily available. So all of those things are challenges. And if you start to have to compromise on those things, you're going to either have to spend more money, spend more time, or eat less food and therefore get less energy. So it's going to impact your race in some way. And when you're outside of kind of big metropolitan areas that have kind of going to provide these options for vegan diets when you're out in the countryside. You're just really at the mercy of whatever you can find quickly, and it's generally going to be gas stations. And what the photographer that's in our crew vehicle that I've been traveling with, Charlotte, has a intolerance to gluten, and she's found it really, really hard. And sometimes she's just had to get like a little tin of like almost like pre-prepared vegetables, and there's the options of what you can eat. You realize when you go into these places you need to just get something quickly. Everything is made of like gluten or meat or dairy, and really there's nothing outside of that. So if your dietary requirements are outside of that, you're really, really struggling. And that's not someone that's riding, so she doesn't need to be consuming like 8,000 calories or whatever you need to do to keep going through a TCR.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, in the later stages of the race, your kind of decision-making functions and bandwidth for thinking about anything other than kind of how am I going to keep pedaling is really limited. So to have that kind of additional logistical thing to factor in is a massive disadvantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Yeah.
Anything else to add to that, anyone?
No, my only observation I was going to make was we had the question yesterday about finding water in Europe, and then today finding food in Europe, and both from people in the US, which makes me wonder if they think Europe is a wasteland of we're all just scraping, you know, at the ground trying to find sustenance as we, wander our way through. But yeah,
I think one of the stories that sort of made me giggle about this subject quite a bit was from Wendy Ellis, who scratched kind of in the Czech Republic, or just I think she maybe made it into Bavaria, and just after she scratched, she was heading home and she found a vending machine that was a vending machine for just cured meats. And it's funny because even in Germany and places in Central Europe, the menus are just full of meat. So finding vegetarian options is quite challenging, even when you think, oh, it's Germany or it's Austria, there'll be loads of veggie options. But oftentimes you're in metropolitan city centres looking for a hipster veggie shop and not getting anywhere.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, look, that's definitely all we've got time for this episode, because we've really got into that and gone quite over time. Just like to thank Ross so much for joining in. It's been a real pleasure having you on the pod.
Thank you very much, guys. Nice to be on.
Thanks to Karen and Rob, as always. Cheers, guys.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
And don't forget, you can send in any questions about TCR. For our veterans to chat about in the upcoming episodes, send those in to the usual email address, race@transcontinental.cc, with pod question as the subject. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and a review if you feel like it, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.